welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. This is the first of three consecutive shows with different guests on The Space Trilogy by C.S. Lewis. We'll get started in a moment with the first book in the series, Out of the Silent Planet. Next week we'll cover Perelandra, and the following week we'll look at That Hideous Strength. Today, for Out of the Silent Planet, our guest is David Whalen, a professor of English at Hillsdale College. He's podcasted with us previously on King Lear by William Shakespeare, as well as David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. He joins us in the studio as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH, in Michigan. David, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
Why is Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis a great book?
Okay, this may be heresy, so be prepared to throw me out, but it's not a great book. It's a good book. It's a very good book.
Sometimes I say this is not the Great Books Podcast. This is a very good books podcast.
That's it. If by great books we're talking about the Iliad and Hamlet, you know, this isn't quite at that level, but it's a very good book, and the trilogy is a very good trilogy. Although, funnily enough, Lewis really didn't like the phrase space trilogy. We all call it the space trilogy, but he rather insisted it be called something else, maybe cosmic trilogy, the Ransom trilogy, something, but just not, and we can probably talk about why later.
We're going to talk about all that, why this book is great or very good, the characters in it, the story behind it, and why it's called the Space Trilogy, or why we call it the Space Trilogy, and whether that's the best name for it. Let's begin at the beginning. The book starts with Elwin Ransom, a professor who is also our protagonist, and he's on a long walk through the countryside by himself when he's drugged and kidnapped and taken on an interplanetary voyage, as happens to professors all the time, right? Who is this guy, David, and what's going on here?
Well, he's a Cambridge professor in summertime, in the off season, on the long holiday, they call it, and he's a philologist, so his interest is in linguistics, and he's fascinated by language and likes to compile dictionaries of languages and that sort of thing. So he's a protagonist, as you say, and we see the story from his point of view almost entirely.
Very early on, though, he has an encounter.
He encounters an old schoolmate, not really a chum. They didn't get along, but a man named Devine, Dick Devine, who is very much into business. He's a London financial wizard of a certain sort, who's hanging out with a guy named Weston, who is one of the most famous physicists in the world. And so the two of them, that is Weston and Devine, kidnap Ransom and haul him into a spaceship they've fashioned and take off for what we know as Mars.
Now, Ransom is a philologist.
Mm-hmm.
Philologists study words.
Right.
First of all, whatever happened to philology as an academic discipline you'd find? And you don't find philologists anymore. At least they don't call themselves that.
Not so much. Some do. And Lewis is deliberately, by calling Ransom a philologist, he's deliberately coating him, so to speak, with the aura of tradition and venerable academic study. I think, frankly, what we now call linguistics has kind of edged out philology. And Lewis sort of deliberately declines to go down that path. He's talking about a philologist, a man steeped in the traditional study of language.
And so by making Ransom a philologist, one of the things he's doing is he's calling our attention to particular words.
Right.
And I'm going to suggest names of characters. So we have Ransom, Devine, and Weston.
Right.
Those are loaded with meaning, I think.
Oh, well, they are. I mean, most people. First of all, Lewis, you do have to be a little careful with Lewis, because he likes to be mischievous as well. And so he's Devine. We think of, oh, Devine, that must mean godlike. Well, this character is not godlike at all. Most people understand Devine to derive from dives, meaning wealth or riches and a love of riches. And that's indeed Devine. He is consumed by greed. He's considered, by the end of the novel, in fact, he's considered just a completely broken man. And by broken, I don't mean his spirit is broken. I mean his humanity is completely smashed.
And Devine, we should point out, is spelled D-E-V-I-N-E.
Right.
So it's kind
right.
of a pun going on
right.
here, in a sense.
It is. And Weston generally generally people think of that as just Western man, that is, man under the kind of intoxicating poison of scientism, a contemporary and progressive fascination with manipulation and mastery over the material world.
And that's what this book is about.
Very much.
Really. Tell us more about scientism. Where does this idea come from? Why is Lewis wanting to write about it in a novel?
Lewis thinks scientism is perhaps the most profound threat facing humanity in the 20th century, maybe 21st century now. Scientism really is the religion of science. I mean, that's the best way to think of it. It is the belief, without evidence, of course, sometimes even without self-awareness, but the belief that the material universe contains within it all that is necessary for a complete and meaningful and purposeful existence, that there's a kind of hardwired teleology, not designed by God, not placed into the cosmos by a creator, but a kind of self-sufficient, meaningful reality sans any kind of spiritual or metaphysical world, that matter is sufficient.
One of the great advocates of scientism was H.G. Wells, who was a predecessor, a right. contemporary, but right. also a predecessor of C.S. Lewis. Out of the Silent Planet, published in 1938, about a generation after War right. of the Worlds and right. Time Machine and the classic science fiction novels of H.G. Wells. Wells makes an appearance
he does.
In the text of the book. He's also in a note mm-hmm. at the start of Out of the Silent Planet. And Lewis writes this, quote, "Certain slighting references to earlier stories of this type, which will be found in the following pages, have been put there for purely dramatic purposes. The author would be sorry if any reader supposed he was too stupid to have enjoyed Mr. H.G. Wells's fantasies or too ungrateful to acknowledge his debt to them." Right. Sounds like Lewis is conflicted about H.G. Wells.
Well, he is. I mean, Lewis likes Wells' fiction and enjoys it, and defends Wells' fiction from accusations of triviality or science fiction banality. Lewis defends Wells from all of that. But at the same time, he knows what Wells is up to. He understands the philosophical underpinnings of Wells' fiction and disagrees with it profoundly.
So we have Elwin Ransom, our hero, the philologist, mm-hmm. runs into Devine and Weston, mm. and they grab him and take him to Mars.
Right.
Why would they do such a thing?
Not because they needed a third person to round out the weight distribution on the spacecraft. They think that they have been charged. They had been to Mars before. They misunderstand what they were told by the inhabitants of Mars. They think they need to bring some kind of sacrificial victim to feed to these creatures called the Saroni. And they're wrong about this, but they're too arrogant and stupid to know they're wrong or to even entertain the possibility. They actually intend to take this young boy who works for them at their little property called The Rise, but they stumble upon, or actually Ransom stumbles upon them, and they take Ransom instead.
So Mars has aliens. There are Martians. Who are these people?
Well, they're more than one kind of people, interestingly enough. The one of the reasons this is such an excellent book is that there's so rich an imagining of a kind of quasi-prelapsarian world where you have different kinds of rational animals, speaking rational animals. In the book, they're called Hneu. That is, any kind of rational speaking being is a Hneu. It's H-N-A-U. Pronounce it however you will. It's another example of Lewis's mischief, is coming up with completely unpronounceable names. But the Hrossa we see the most of. These are seal-like, snake-like, hair-covered, poetic beasts. They sing, they write poetry, they lead a kind of heroic life. Clearly, Lewis is thinking about, you know, the classical world, the ancient world, the sort of Homeric world of man. And then there are also these other beings, very tall, very slim, rather scientific and philosophical beings, scientific in a proper sense, not scientistic sense, and they're called the Saroni. And then there's a third category of being on this planet on Mars, which is called by its own inhabitants, Malacandra, something might be pronounced Fifeltrig. These are craftsmen. These are sort of builders, people with great facility, with dexterous manufacture. There are also angel-like figures called Eldilla on the planet, and they all interact. All four of these animal species and the more light-like Eldilla beings all interact and speak to each other and understand each other, even though they're very different.
Sounds a little bit like the cantina scene in Star Wars with all these different creatures.
That's it exactly. I mean, it's important to understand these aren't different. We wouldn't call them races. These aren't like different races. They're not the same species at all. They're radically different beings, all of which, however, are rational and can speak.
Quick question about names. We keep saying that they go to Mars. They call it Malacandra.
Right.
We actually don't know it's Mars for a little while.
No, that's right.
In the book. Why is it called Malacandra? Why is this destination mysterious to us for a little while?
What Lewis is doing is suggesting that the cosmos has a kind of ancient, venerable history and reality of which the world, you and I, of which the world is completely unaware. And that venerable history includes names. So, for instance, Earth has a name, too. It's Thulcandra, which means silent planet. So the silent planet in Out of the Silent Planet means Earth. And it's silent because its tutelary spirit, a sort of angelic tutelary protective spirit over the planet, each planet in the solar system has one, and ours was, quote-unquote, bent, in other words, fallen. So clearly he's thinking of Satan, the fallen angel, and each other planet has an unfallen angel. And the names of these planets are indicative of their affiliation with an angelic figure called an Oyarsa. And those protective spirits and the names of the planets indicate a great past history of which people on Earth are terribly unaware.
Ransom is alive to the possibility of this majesty. He's open to learning about it and so forth. Weston and Divine, our villains, are not. They're obtuse. So what happens when they bring Ransom to Mars, to Malacandra?
Right.
What conflict ensues?
Well, he escapes. And the conflict is, one way to look at it is very simple. You have genuine receptivity to learning and knowledge versus a voracious desire to exploit and to dominate. And of course, Ransom wishes to learn. He learns to speak the native language and languages.
Helps to be a philologist when you're trying to learn an alien language.
Helps very much, you know. And Lewis kind of Lewis considers himself a philologist as well, at least in part. And he makes fun of himself, you know, at the moment. Not to get into details, but at the very moment he first meets Hross, one of these, you know, seal-like figures, and he realizes it's speaking, he wants to run away. Wisdom, prudence would suggest, run away, you've got a strange creature, you don't know if it means you well or ill. But the fact that it speaks holds him fast, and he says, oh, goodness, to be enslaved but by your academic passions. He just couldn't resist trying to learn something of this creature's language. And so he does. It does help that he's a philologist. But again, that central conflict is the conflict between receptivity to learning about the reality of things and the desire to, the sort of feverish desire to master and dominate and exploit material reality.
And this brings Weston, especially Weston,
yes, right.
in conflict with these angelic-like figures you mentioned. How do they clash, and what does Ransom do to help them communicate?
Ransom ends up acting as a kind of, towards the end of the novel, middle to end, the Oyarsa of the planet. That's, again, that protective tutelary spirit. And Weston and Divine and Ransom are all speaking together. Weston and Divine have killed several of the creatures on the planet, several Hrossa, have been slain by Weston and Divine. And so the tutelary spirit is getting involved now. You know, you're messing with my people. I've got to get down here and straighten this out. You are a threat to my planet, the planet that I'm here to protect. And so Ransom is, however, much more than just an interpreter. Ransom explains this Oyarsa, the spirit, even though it's angelic in its kind of intelligence, it doesn't know much about human beings because the Earth is a silent planet. So all these other unfallen, pure intelligences don't really understand what's wrong with man, what's wrong with the creatures on that planet. And so Ransom has to tell him. He has to kind of explain what these vices are, what animates Weston and Divine, and what's wrong with them, and the kind of threat. In fact, Ransom says, look, we are a threat to the peaceful pre-lapsarian inhabitants of this planet. It would be better for us to be gone, and if we can't be sent back, then kill us.
It almost sounds like a parable of imperialism or colonialism.
There's that. It's all in there. Yes, that there is an element of that. Although Lewis is not so much interested politically and economically in those facets of imperialism that occupy most people's attention today, he's interested in the kind of poverty, the interior spiritual poverty of an entire civilization possessed of nothing but greed or progressive materialism.
And he helps expose it in these conversations.
That he exposes it, he analyzes it, he shows its poverty. That's really one of the principal efforts of this entire novel, is to try to get us to see ourselves, and that I mean that on a cultural and civilization level, and realize the kind of galling interior poverty that characterizes us without our even being aware of it.
David, Out of the Silent Planet is the first book in what we commonly call the Space Trilogy. You've already said C.S. Lewis wasn't crazy about that name. Why do we call it that? What does this word even mean, space? Because it does come up in the book.
Expressly. He rejects the title Space Trilogy because in this book, in the others as well, he rejects the idea of space in its modern construal. If you think about how we imagine the cosmos, the modern scientific imagining of the cosmos is as a massive, cold, lifeless vacuum where there are these isolated little globs of stuff and perhaps life, but primarily the cosmos is an emptiness. Lewis thinks not just that this is wrong, but he thinks this is impoverishing. I've been talking about the impoverished, you know, modern spirit.
This is scientism talking.
Bingo. That is one of the reasons the universe is to be mastered and dominated, is because it's a nothing. And we're kind of going to rearrange that nothingness into something of our own, to our own pleasing, to a place to our own, put to our own uses. Well, He thinks that, in fact, space isn't a dead vacuum. The older tradition, whereby what we call space is known as the heavens, which suggests a fullness, a plenitude, a kind of vitality and warmth and radiant richness of being. That is more real and true and nourishing of a healthy Western imagination as compared to the modern scientific one that, without even fully being aware of it, tends to think of the universe as a dead thing.
This is a novel. It's a work of fiction. What genre is it? Would you call it science fiction? Is it a theological novel, a novel of ideas? How would you label this thing?
I would label it science fiction. I think Lewis would. He defends science fiction from those who would attack it as, again, a kind of low or banal form of literature. He has no problem with science fiction being as respectable a kind of fantastic fiction as other sorts. So yes, I think I would. Along with Lewis, categorize this as a science fiction novel. But that doesn't mean it isn't also a novel of ideas. Even though there is there's a great deal of religious allusion and content woven throughout the novel, I wouldn't describe it as a theological novel. It is a novel of not even of ideas so much as it's a novel of imaginings. That's I think, the key point. The reason this is a good novel is because it's so richly and vividly imagined as a prelapsarian world, that is, Malacandra, Mars, what would it be like? What would it be like to have a world with multiple rational creatures, types of creatures, species of rational animal? What would it be like to work and talk and live among unfallen beings, beings who are essentially free of a kind of corruption, interior corruption of mind and heart? What would that be like? That's what Lewis does in this novel.
It raises this question of what's sometimes called exotheology, which is the problem or potential problem for Christians of the existence of extraterrestrial intelligent life. What would that mean for us as Christians, and what does Lewis say about that?
What Lewis says, interestingly, is also said later by an American novelist, Walker Percy, and that is the first and most important question for an extraterrestrial intelligent being would be, so are you fallen or not? And again, I think to a modern scientific imagination, that's just an incomprehensible question with an incomprehensible urgency. But for Lewis, the most important question is, are you bent? Are you broken? Or are you whole and complete? And of course, man after the fall is bent. We're not completely ruined, but we're certainly cracked through and through. And that is the driving sort of exotheological question. Is this other intelligence in communion with its creator, or in a kind of isolation and silent distance from its creator?
And what about these aliens on Mars? What is their status?
They're in communion. Lewis liked to complicate things, and so he's not going to give you a pure and simple, sweet angel, for instance, in these Eldils. They have a kind of body, and it's a kind of light. He might have picked that up from John Milton, who thought of angels as being composed of matter, but in a very sort of ethereal way. But anyway, they're essentially prelapsarian. They're not lapsed. Again, one could argue and point to those few lines in the book where Lewis makes sure to include the idea that history records way back there was one Ross that did some weird stuff, you know. But basically, these are people that are utterly in communion with the word for God here is Maladil.
This is reminding me a little bit of the Chronicles of Narnia, the spirit of this book. And Narnia comes later in the career of Lewis. I don't even know if he's imagining it at this point. Those are 1950s books. We're still in the 1930s with Out of the Silent Planet. But is this like Narnia in its outlook and perspective in a broad sense?
In a broad sense, yes. In a narrower sense, there are many ways in which it's unlike Narnia. But broadly speaking, in the Christian imagination and the realist imagination that underpins the novel, it would share those underpinnings with Narnia. However, I don't think Lewis thought of this trilogy as children's literature in particular, and certainly he did with Narnia. It's true that these novels, the trilogy, could be read by youngish readers, but I don't think the younger children would really enjoy the novels as much as older readers would.
There's clearly a comfort with unconventional thinking, or at least using different kinds of stories and mythology to tell a Christian story in maybe a disguised way.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think Lewis might say that all of those mythologies actually are refractions and reflections of a deeper unifying and Christian reality.
But he was comfortable with pagan ideas, and
completely.
He didn't, right. And the point, I guess my point is, he didn't reject pagan ideas as much as he was interested in them and wanted to see what was true about them and what about them was consistent
absolutely.
With his own Christian belief.
No, absolutely. In fact, he thinks it's even beyond a matter of consistency. Those pagan mythologies are halting and limited attempts to wrap the mind and the narrative understanding of existence around a larger truth that took revelation to make plain to us. So, yes, Lewis loves these pagan mythologies as sources of truth, limited and partial, but real.
There's a great line toward the end of Out of the Silent Planet, which is this, quote, What we need for the moment is not so much a body of belief as a body of people familiarized with certain ideas. If we could even affect in 1% of our readers a changeover from the conception of space to the conception of heaven, we should have made a beginning, unquote. This sounds like Lewis talking about preparing the imagination for the reality of Christian faith and so on and so forth, what he says about Narnia. What does that quote mean? What does it mean here in this book?
I think you pegged it. I think that's it exactly. The book's primary purpose, its primary object, is to essentially reanimate the Western imagination, or at least to make the Western to make us realize that we need our imaginations reanimated, rebuilt, refurbished. That they are kind of in this starved and enervated condition, and that's that business about heaven and space. That is his litmus test, or that is his perfect instance or example of the way our imagination has gone wrong, how we are fundamentally crippled in the way that we just think of our own existences. So that's really the point of the book's point is to tap us on the shoulder, say, wake up. We have given away a kind of glorious birthright. It's not just old-fashioned. He's not saying, wasn't it quaint and romantic and squishy and poetic back when people thought of the heavens? He thinks that it's true, that the cosmos is a created home filled with a vibrant, pulsing life that we have traded for a mess of cold, lifeless, vacuous pottage.
Out of the Silent Planet is pleasingly short for a novel. My copy is 160 pages. Yeah. Is it complete in and of itself? Do you have to go on to the next book in the trilogy?
That's such a good question. It is complete. It is complete, but it's also, it's not conceived by itself. That is, he knows he's going to go on to these other things, and he does more than just foreshadow them in the novel. So, yes, you could stop here, but you shouldn't.
So how does this book then connect with the second in the trilogy, which is called Perelandra?
Well, we need another half an hour.
You have 30 seconds.
Okay. All right. It sets up the second novel of the trilogy, which occurs on Venus. This Martian novel, this Malachandrian novel, represents and embodies a kind of masculine real identity. Venus will embody a kind of feminine identity. One of the things that Lewis is doing, he's trying to use the reality of the sexes. I think this is especially delicious and ironic given the contemporary confusion about matters of sex. But he is trying to use the given reality of male and female as a kind of key to opening the wonders of a given created cosmos.
A lot of people say this trilogy gets better as it goes along, or at least that the best work of the three is the third, called That Hideous Strength. Do you agree with that?
Yes, but only in the sense that the climax occurs in that third novel. I hope this doesn't discourage any potential readers, but Out of the Silent Planet is kind of thin when it comes to plot. It's very descriptive. It's reflective even. And then Perelandra is rich in a kind of in the rhetoric of temptation and rebuttal. It's also thin in plot. The final novel is not thin in plot. That's where all the action occurs, or a lot of action. So yes, it's best in the sense that all these things are pointed to that, and they see their completion in that third novel.
Last question as we wrap up. What's the case for reading this book and this trilogy now?
The case now is what it was. If you look at the last 20, 30 pages of this novel, Ransom talks about Actually, the Oyarsa spoke about the cosmos coming into a period of crisis and urgency. I think Lewis really thought that. That is, that we, the human race, especially in the Western world, is approaching a kind of crisis point. You know, this business of greed and scientism is pushing us to the brink of a kind of collapse. And if we don't get our house in order, we're done for. So I think that is more true now than it was when Lewis wrote these novels, and so they're even more pressingly urgent and pertinent, I think.
David Whalen, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about Out of the Silent Planet, the first book of the space trilogy by C.S. Lewis.
Well, a few words from me can't do the book or the trilogy justice, but I'm very delighted to be here.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Please send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com on Twitter. My handle is @heymiller. And last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.